Dogs seem to know everything about their owners, from their schedules to their scents to exactly what annoys us, or is that just you? I don't know. So shouldn't humans know everything about their dogs? Well, Embark's dog DNA test allows you to do just that. Getting to know your dog's breed mix and genetic health risks with Embark means strengthening your bond with your furry friend. And Embark founded the world's first canine relative finder. I have actually found distant cousins of Geo's. Anyway, we'll get there. They even offer you the ability to connect directly with other Embark dog owners in their database. We'd like to thank EmbarkVet.com for supporting And That's Why We Drink. And you can go to EmbarkVet.com to get free shipping and save $50 on the breed and health test with promo code DRINK. So Geo is quite a situation. All right, I got the Embark test done, and he is American Pit Bull Terrier. He is Shih Tzu. He's Australian Cattle Dog, Dachshund Chow Chow, German Shepherd, and Labrador Retriever. He is, as by the way, Embark put it, which made me so happy, he is a super mutt. Isn't that nice? I was thrilled because I had done a test on him ages ago, but it was like pretty simple and like kind of just not very, very in-depth. This Embark test was amazing. It told us that he was part Dachshund, which made a lot of sense because he's kind of like hot dog shaped. Get the dog DNA test that is trusted by millions. Right now, Embark has a limited time offer on their breed and health test for our listeners. Go to EmbarkVet.com to get free shipping and save $50 with promo code DRINK. Visit EmbarkVet.com and use promo code DRINK to save $50 today.
Out here in the middle of these acres, it can feel like you're the only person on earth. That's how it feels when you're struggling with your mental health, but you don't have to feel alone. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
Welcome to the epicenter of Clorox.
We should talk about that, huh?
In the midst of
a national crisis?
Apparently, what
a pandemic.
Has become a national crisis, and we were like, oh, we'll be fine, and then all of a sudden we're like, I guess we won't be, though.
Yes.
And I'm so sorry. I hope everyone's doing okay, and feeling safe and healthy and trying their best to wash their hands.
Yes.
We unfortunately had to cancel all of our March shows.
Yes. If by now you know this, but it is probably good to say in case you are not following us on Instagram, right, or Facebook or anything like that. But we planned on powering through.
We did.
And we were like, we're going to go to these shows. You know, a lot of people wanted to see us. And then a lot of governors started making a lot of calls.
All these governors decided they wanted to tell us what to do.
So that, I mean, at the end of the day, it was probably obviously a very good thing.
Yeah.
People probably wouldn't have actually come to the show anyway.
Yep.
Because maybe some of them were too afraid to come out in public, or
yep,
were afraid of catching something. Plus, Christine does have an autoimmune disease that we like to neglect often.
I constantly neglect it. And then my doctor was like, just so you know, you're a high risk patient. And then he said that and I went, oh, I don't like those words.
Yeah. So it's for the best that we didn't.
And
have
like
the shows,
for me, but we were just going to keep, I was like, I'll just fist bump people. Like I was more, I think we're more worried about the people in the audience. Like, we wouldn't be as much in
right
contact with everybody. But apparently, whatever it was, we didn't even get to decide. Everyone chose for us. So I'm
right
so sorry about that. We're pretty, actually very bummed out.
Yeah.
We had a lot of people coming, like, from our own families to New York and Boston and D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So they're being postponed. They're not canceled. Like, they're being rescheduled.
Right. They're being rescheduled, yeah, probably near the fall.
Yeah.
But we have nothing confirmed yet, so please don't take our words as, like, a sure thing.
Gospel.
Right. But we hope everyone's doing okay. Toilet paper is...
Oh, my God.
Scarce.
Our dumb asses tried to buy toilet paper 5 minutes ago.
Hand sanitizer, obviously, is just, like, something that doesn't exist anymore.
It's amazing. It's, like, a black market product all of a sudden.
It's really crazy. And today happens to be, like, really rainy outside, and it's...
Yeah, in LA, which is, like, ultra weird.
It's a very weird time. It's kind of... feels a little bit like the morning after the election. Like, everyone...
Yes! Everyone's off the streets.
Everyone was just kind of...
Yeah.
Like just a little extra on edge and a little afraid
and, also,
and a,
like,
little concerned about
feeling,
what the fuck's coming up.
Yeah, vulnerable and, like, not sure what to do. And, I mean, like, Em earlier was like, well, and tomorrow, apparently, there's supposed to be all these thunderstorms. I was like, tomorrow's also Friday the 13th. So, like,
yeah,
we're in this weird doomsday situation at this point.
It's a very odd feeling. And, like, we're trying to, like, I mean, it's gotten to a point where, like, I don't know what the rest of the world looks like, but I've had my mom sending me toilet paper because it literally just doesn't exist anymore. Like,
yeah,
in the stores that I've looked at Costco, I've looked at Target, I've looked at Ralph's, I've looked at Trader Joe's, I've looked at Walmart, I've looked at Target. Like, everywhere I've looked, like, there are just, like, aisles that are turned over and, like, they're not restocking
them. Right.
And, like, I mean, there's obviously there's more issues than toilet paper. There's a lot of, like, racial issues happening right now.
Oh,
and,
yeah. It's honestly things like this, I think, bring out the worst in a lot of people, or like just fear like this brings out a lot of negativity in people, and like the dark parts of humanity sometimes come out. So, yeah, not great. I also, you know, like Cincinnati schools, I found out are closing for at least 3 weeks starting to Monday. And like, you know, there are a lot of people who depend on school lunches and that kind of thing. And so,
and some people are like, it's not a matter of like, like, it's nice to think, like, oh, some people don't even have to go to work, but it's, like, some people are living paycheck to paycheck and need that. And
they have to go, right.
So, it is very scary for a lot of people. A lot of, specifically, like, Chinese establishments are losing a lot of business because a lot of people out there are
just decided making decisions. That suddenly their Chinese food is going to give them coronavirus, as if that's a thing.
So, there's a lot of people out there who are desperately hurting. Also, I found out that our old campus, Boston University, all schools in Boston have apparently like just stopped for like the whole semester. And there's a lot of people who are international students in Boston University. And so I don't know where they plan on moving because they just got kicked off campus, but they can't fly out of the country. And so it's getting kind of pretty wild.
Yeah, it's definitely pulling in all different directions. So I just on that note,
I hope you're doing okay.
Yeah, I hope you're okay. Reach out if you need help or if you know someone who needs help.
Yep. Everyone be kind to each other.
Just, be kind. Wash your hands.
Wash your goddamn hands. It's weird. It's a weird feeling that's going on because I feel like now we have to have like a comedy show, but everyone's scared for their lives. Because
No, no, you go.
I just have a lot of feelings.
When don't we though?
But no, I was telling Christine, I was like, this does like for all the shows like The Walking Dead or like any apocalyptic based show, you never really see like what the initial very gradual like signs, like what those small signs might be of like the beginning of the end of the world.
Yep.
But now it's like, of course, toilet paper would be the first thing to run out and soap would be the first thing to run out. And like, tiny little things that you wouldn't pick up on, but it's like the beginning of a real issue.
Yeah.
And also, it just happens to be raining and it literally never rains in LA. And so it just,
it the added whole to the
ambiance is off.
Yeah. It's feeling a little dark. So I just thought it was worth mentioning just so get it out of the way. We know what's going on. We are very sorry about having to cancel our shows. We really didn't want to do that. It's not ideal. And we know this is like messing up a lot of people's travel plans. And we tried. We really tried to avoid it. But unfortunately, those governors are always
making decisions,
bossing us around. Like, who do they think they are?
Realistically, I'm sure there is some silver lining that we haven't found yet in this. And not to say that that's for everybody, but I'm sure we'll make do with what we've got. So,
yeah. Also, I think that like the special patron of the week is going to feel so honored that their episode is the Corona episode.
Right.
Our patron of the week is Z Bates.
Z Bates. All right.
Is for Zika. Remember that? Let's think about that and how now we're all okay. So that'll happen too.
Sure.
That's
in enough time, everyone will be okay. Even though this is like our version of like Scarlet Fever.
Also, like not everyone will be okay, but
not
unfortunately.
Everyone. Fingers crossed at least Tom Hanks is okay.
Yeah, poor Tom. But yeah, so I just wanted to say sorry about that and hope everyone's doing okay. And thank you, Z, for your Patreon support.
Yes, we're thinking of everyone and we hope everyone who has like maybe even just older family relatives that they're worried about or anything like that. We hope everyone's doing okay.
Absolutely. And I also wanted to, can I make like a little promo talking about shows real quick?
Sure.
So,
you can do whatever you want. It's your goddamn show.
I know. Well, okay. So my brothers and my podcast has a Beach to Sandy.
Oh, it's your other goddamn show.
My other show. Mm-hmm. Beach to Sandy, Water to Wet. We have our first shows ever and we're like kind of terrified we're not going to sell any tickets. So, it's the Cincinnati show is the day after the And That's Why You Drink Cincinnati show. So if you want to double up and see me twice in one weekend, go for it. Or maybe spot Bernie in the crowd. And we have a show in LA in May, as far as I know, until further notice, the show is still on. But so Yeah, if anyone wants to come, we're trying to sell tickets, so.
What if it wasn't because of the coronavirus, it was just because you're so bad?
I mean, that's literally my fear. Beachtosanity.com/tour if anyone wants to come. If you're sad that you can't make it to our Boston show. I'm just using this to my advantage. I'm sorry.
That's fine. It's your platform.
I'm just desperate that we're not selling too many tickets, so we're trying our best.
I think it just is a very unlucky time to start selling tickets.
Yeah, it's a very unfortunate timing.
It's not you. It's a pandemic.
But fortunately...
it's also Houdini, probably.
It's not you. It's not me. It's not Houdini. It's just this damn pandemic.
It's just a global pandemic.
It's all these governors. I just wanted to give that a little shout out because that's in May, and I'm looking forward to hopefully in May. Remember how Trump said that all the warm weather will stop the virus?
Okay.
So let's do that. Let's just pretend that's real.
And then you'll go see Bishu Sandy.
Yeah. Yep.
That'll be the way we celebrate.
I think so. So that's that.
Great. Other than that, how have you been? Good?
Oh, good. Thank you very much. How have you been?
Good. We had a little treat for Eva this weekend.
Yep.
I don't know how much... You let me know how much I'm allowed to say.
Oh, no. This is a joint effort.
So, Eva is obsessed with... I didn't know this until we had a show in Alabama. Mm. But Eva's obsessed with NASA and rockets and space and the galaxy.
Her dad worked for NASA for a while. So, like, legit.
Mm-hmm.
And has, like, a cool coin from NASA.
And so, Eva's birthday was this weekend. And we had said... We were trying to figure out what we were going to do for our birthday, and we've legitimately thought about actually sending her to space camp in Alabama.
We truly Googled it to find out.
And it just ended up not logistically working, and so
wonder why.
And so we were like, I wish we could just maybe make... I think my exact words were like, knowing how extra we are, we could probably just make our own space camp here. And then Christine was like, well, okay, let's do that.
And was just like reading my face, and I was like, yes.
So we made Eva space camp, and so we got to play a whole bunch of games.
Oh, God, it was so cool. I walked in, and Emma had put up all this... So Em and I both brought space stuff, but like somehow found like different space stuff. So it was quite a combo.
It was quite an accumulation of galaxy themed things.
Em had planned all these activities and like arts and crafts. I mean, it was so much fun. And we
Christine was a bar master for the day and made like galaxy swirl constellation drinks.
Em called it Christine's drunk kitchen.
I did.
I will say too, we filmed it and I'm working on editing it now. And I guess now that we're off for a month, I can find the time to edit it. And that's going to be kind of like our Lemonscape video is going to be on Patreon for our patrons.
Yes.
Trying to make some more like long form content for you guys. And it was super fun and really cool. And Eva's just a gem.
Yes. If you haven't said happy birthday to her yet online, go do it, please.
Oh, yeah. Go do it.
Because she's a goddamn gem.
She is a goddamn delight.
She is.
I love that.
By the way, she graduated from space camp, in case you were wondering.
Oh, she did.
She's our favorite little no longer cadet.
I think she's actually valedictorian.
She was. 1 out of 1.
Summa cum laude. It was amazing. So, 1 out of 1.
So,
I failed. So you got engaged. Congrats. Now you may be wondering what's next. If you're planning a wedding, the first thing you need to know about is Zola. In fact, I actually shout this at any friends I have who are engaged because it saved my life when I was planning my wedding. Zola has everything you need to plan your wedding in one place, including venue options and all your vendors. Plus, you can design save the dates and invites, build a free wedding website, create your registry, and stay on track and on budget throughout the entire process with their free planning tools. I tell my friends Zola is a one-stop shop, right? This is the key to planning a wedding. I didn't even have a wedding planner. I used Zola and they were so, so helpful on every front. Everything from save the dates to a wedding website to online RSVPs to finding vendors. With Zola, you can plan your entire wedding in one convenient place. From the day you get engaged and search for the venue to the day you send out your save the dates, make your registry, and even taste your cake. Zola has literally everything you need to make the whole process super easy and actually enjoyable. There's even a 5-star app that helps you plan on the go or on your couch. Start planning at Zola.com. That's Zola.com. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like when you're hiring for your business. You want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/drink. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/drink. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/drink. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
My story this time around has been requested by many. I'm not going to shout out names because it would take too long. So many people have asked for this.
Okay.
I thought it was a fun little change of things because it's kind of haunted, kind of conspiracy theory, kind of just one big fun fact.
Ooh!
I know. So I don't know if you've heard of this, but this is the story of the Poltergeist Curse movie. The movie Poltergeist.
Oh, I feel like I've seen people suggest it, but I don't really know much about it.
So all I knew about it was that have you seen the Poltergeist?
I have not.
Okay. Or the Poltergeist. Okay, so if you've seen
we're like old people, like, have you listened on the Spotify?
I went down to the Wally World and there's no more toilet paper. I'm sorry, no more TP. So so if you have not seen the movie, it's about this family, the Freelings. They move into this house, and then I don't mean to spoil it for you, but you've had like 30 years to watch it.
There's like the statute of limitations has expired.
So basically they move into a house, and then they find out later that it was built over a cemetery, and like, ooh, all these bodies are buried underneath it. And so the youngest girl, I don't know if you know the reference, but the creepy little girl voice that goes, "They're here." That's famous scary movie catchphrase. That came from Poltergeist because the little girl, basically all the spirits are trying to talk to them through the TV set.
Yuck.
And then near the end of the movie, the girl, the daughter, the youngest daughter, just goes missing. And so the family has to reach out to this medium to help them find the girl and get the girl back from the ghosts. So it's a really good movie. It's like one of the classics. Produced by Steven Spielberg.
Oh, there you go.
Fun fact. Also, it was, it came out in 1982 and MGM released it. It was the 8th highest grossing film of the year and had 3 Oscar nominations.
Wow. And I feel like that's rare for like a horror movie, right? Or a scary movie.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
To get like highbrow.
high caliber
awards.
So The Curse, which is where I lost my tangent, but I was going into this saying like,
you'll find it.
I'm back on my groove. So the curse that I understood was that the little girl, the one that says, "They're here," I knew, like, after only a couple months of filming the movies, she died. Like,
in real life?
Like, unexpectedly died.
Oh, shit.
And so that's what I thought the Poltergeist curse was, where it was, like, after making a movie and, like, inviting all that kind of, like, bad energy, all of a sudden she died. And so they
sounds like a curse to me.
It could have, like, obviously just been, like, a freak accident that people associate with the movie. But I always thought that was the curse of, like, oh, this little girl who is so important and crucial in the movies then just died randomly.
Yikes.
So, like, of course they're going to make it, like, a little curse.
Sure.
What I ended up finding out, though, is that the Poltergeist curse is that pretty much, like, I'm not going to say all, but a massive chunk of the cast and crew throughout and after filming these movies all died in weird ways.
What?
And so they think that it's, like, if you worked on the movie, it, like, you cursed yourself.
Oh, God.
And either some people, to be fair, just died of, like, a natural cause, but I am going to mention those deaths just so you can see, like, how many.
Sure.
Like, the body count. Oh, terrible.
My God.
So, anyway, and also, Poltergeist, it's a trilogy, just so we're clear.
Oh, okay. Also, like, does that mean we're screwed because, like, all we do is talk about this stuff?
Honestly, at this point, if I don't die in a freak accident, it will be kind of odd.
Oh, my God.
I hope it doesn't happen for a long time. But
as you say, in the midst of a corona pandemic.
Right. If I'm the only... please don't let me die from the coronavirus.
I won't let you die.
If I do, though, that funeral better be fucking popping. I'm just saying.
Oh, don't worry.
Okay.
Don't you even worry about it.
We all know my ghost is going to be there. I'm going to be counting every single person who actually shows and see who I was important to.
You're going
to
have a checklist at hand. I know.
1,000%. So here are some of the weird events. We're just going to jump right into it. So during the production of the first one in 1981, there's a famous scene in it where, like, a mechanical clown doll, like, attacks the little boy in the family.
Okay.
So the mechanical clown, while filming, it attacks the son named Robbie, and the crew actually thought that the guy who played Robbie, Oliver, he was like a 9-year-old boy, and they thought he was giving a great performance, but they actually found out after the fact that the mechanical clown had fallen on him and he was literally choking to death.
What?
So they had to pull, he ended up, so.
They were like, yeah, good work.
They were like, wow, that guy knows how to act like he's dying.
Oh, that's horrifying.
So There is an urban legend that goes around every now and then that says that Robbie was actually the first cast member or crew member to die on the Poltergeist set. But that's an urban legend. They pulled the mechanical clown off. He survived. He was fine.
What a way to go. I mean, truly, that would have been bad.
How do you tell people later he was choked by a mechanical clown?
While everybody watched.
And applauded.
Yeah, applauded.
But yeah, so people say he died. He did not. He's still alive. Or he was still alive after that.
Oh,
so,
okay. Gotta go. Got it.
Then, so Jo Beth Williams was the actress who played the matriarch of the family.
Okay.
She was also kind of one of the main characters. The whole family was the main characters, but she had played a big role in the show, in the movie. She did say that while they were filming this movie, she would go home every night and all of the pictures in her house would be crooked.
Goodbye.
And she would fix them and then she would leave and then come back the next day and they'd be crooked all over again.
And then she would set the house on fire and run far away.
Yeah. And she said that that happened during the second Poltergeist movie too. So it was like, she almost had like this weird feeling of like, should I even be doing this movie? So,
oh God. And isn't that very poltergeisty, right? Like to
literally poltergeisty to be like messing with your shit
and put it in like weird angles and stuff.
Ugh, yep.
Yucko.
So also some of the crew got mysteriously ill during filming and during, this is actually kind of not only a fun fact, but also a theory as to why this curse even exists is because during the climax of the original film, basically the matriarch of the family, she ends up in this pool and all of these skeletons are coming out, like, because it's basically like the ground is flooding. And so she ends up in this like hole and all of the skeletons buried under the house are like coming to life and coming after her. So obviously you would think as an actress, like, oh, these skeletons are fake. But
don't even
the prop master
don't even
for especially during this time period, it was very common for the skeletons to be real.
You're kidding with me.
I'm not. So apparently the prop master for the Poltergeist, Poltergeist.
Don't even notice. So you could just keep doing it.
The prop master's name was Bruce Kaysen, and he said that the skeletons came from Carolina Medical. And at this time, just like a fun fact altogether, is that back in the 70s and 80s, real skeletons were used so much more often than prop skeletons. And that's just not in movies. That's in like mini golf displays
and like universities, roller coasters. And then you're like mini golf.
No, like anywhere where like a skeleton, like a pirate display would be, the skeletons were real.
Yeah, that happened. What was that story where they were on a ride or something and there was always a skeleton and then they found out later it was like a murder victim?
I think it was Pirates of the Caribbean ride or
no,
something?
No, it was like from a fair in like the 19-somethings. It turned out to be a murder victim. I don't remember what. I think it was, I listened to it on Lore or something, but yeah, then they thought it was like, oh, cool, a prop. And then it turns out someone had literally hid a body there and like,
oh, shit.
Nobody fucking noticed.
Oh my gosh. Well, apparently skeletons at that time were a lot cheaper to use. And they were also, so not only were they more cost effective, but they were also just more available because a lot of props that are made with like plastic or silicone started in the late 80s.
Oh, sure.
So up until then, it was really hard to get access to fake skeletons. So they just would just get them from medical places. So, and also keep in mind, like, Jo Beth Williams, who played this actress, she thought they were fake skeletons.
Oh, they didn't tell her?
They didn't tell her. And so there was like 4 to 5 days. I watched her in an interview saying there was like a good week where they had, it was such a big scene and it was such a messy scene that resets took forever. So she did this scene over and over for a week and she was just covered in skeletons. And now she like looks back and she was like, they were real, but dead bodies.
All of those dead bodies.
And like, she had to obviously look scared. And she was like, had I known they were real skeletons, I would have absolutely been really scared.
I actually was going to say, wouldn't it have been more effective to be like, oh, by the way, these are real bodies, like in the middle of the scene.
I know.
Just to get like real fear on her face.
So the use of, I mean, this goes without saying, but the use of genuine human remains has often been cited as the cause of the Poltergeist curse.
Why?
Some speculate that a spirit could be attached to some of these skeletons, and it doesn't like that they're using, like, their human remains are not being respected. They're being thrown around in mud and, like, being propped up against actresses.
And you could argue, like, oh, well, they donated their body. Yeah, to science, probably.
Right.
Not, like, to Hollywood.
But so, yeah, so a lot of people think, like, oh, the curse happened because they were literally disturbing human remains.
That makes sense.
Which is ironic because the whole point of this movie is that they moved into a house on top of a cemetery.
This is frightening.
And they're disturbing, like, the resting place of these bodies. So Anyway, after the film's release, the writer who was actually going to do like a novelization of the movie, his name was James Caan, and his house in the middle of him working was struck by a lightning bolt.
What?
And the weird part beyond that, which is like probably like a one in a million thing of happening, he is quoted talking about it later saying, "The lights went out in my house. The facing on the air conditioning unit blew off, flew across the room and hit me in the back. And after about a minute, the lights flickered and went back on by themselves, and all of the video games in my house started playing by themselves."
No!
So he apparently also collected, like, arcade games, and all of them started, like, going on and off and...
With all that, like, tinny music?
Yeah. So that happened right after the film releasing. Then, just after the premiere, Richard Lawson, who played the character Ryan, he nearly dies of a cocaine overdose, but he survives.
Okay.
5 months after the movie's premiere... This is, like, the worst one when it comes to the original movie. 5 months after the premiere, actress Dominique Dunn, who played the oldest daughter of the family, she was attacked by her ex. So in 1981, she was in a relationship with a guy named John Sweeney, who was a chef at a restaurant in L.A. Apparently, he was super abusive and jealous, and they fought constantly. John was known for regularly beating her up. And one night he even tried to, like, jump on her car to stop her from driving away. And so that was the night that she moved out. But that Halloween, I don't know if this was his way of trying to win her back or something, but he carved a chocolate mask. He, like, carved a chocolate mask to look like her.
Ugh!
And then he delivered it to her door.
What a way to win someone back, right?
But then after a brief argument, he strangled her into a coma. And he even told the police he thought he killed her. But she was just unconscious.
In a coma? Holy shit.
5 days later, she never woke up from the coma and died at 22 years old.
That's so fucking tragic. 22.
And he was found guilty of second-degree manslaughter and only served 3.5 years.
Great.
And when he got out, he changed his name and no one knows where he is.
Great.
So she was the first official death.
What a piece of shit.
So the second movie comes out in 1985, and the main cast all reprise their roles, obviously, except for Dominique, where they explained her absence as she, like, went off to college in this movie.
Oh, sure.
But so the parents, or the people that play the parents, Craig Nelson and Joe Beth Williams, both reported that the second they got on the set, it, like, was really uncomfortable. It was almost like any energy that was played with or messed around with from the first movie had come back because, like, I mean, the same crew and the same cast are all together again, so they, like, that energy probably felt it.
Sure.
Showed up on set. They all said it felt really uncomfortable. They also now knew at this point that they had been fucking around with human bodies.
Right.
And the worst part is, like, reportedly, allegedly, the same prop master came back and brought more fucking real skeletons to the set to film the second movie. So they were like,
absolutely not.
So then the cast and crew were like, so we're going to mess with, like,
adding more souls to this.
Yeah. We're going to mess with more body remains.
This is wow. Okay.
So Will Sampson, who played a, Native American shaman in the movie, he also is, like, apparently in real life, also a shaman.
Mm-hmm.
He was fucking uncomfortable with it. He was like, I didn't know. Had I known the first time around that those were real skeletons, I wouldn't have even fucking, like, done this job.
It's amazing they didn't tell anybody.
Yeah, especially when you're, like, a fucking shaman is on set and you're gonna not tell
and
them.
Especially
that
someone's, like, drowning in them and you're like, no, they're fake, don't worry.
And so
should be illegal.
I don't know if they ever, like, specifically lied, but definitely danced around the truth until after the fact.
Sure.
But so Will Sampson, he was like, I'm not coming back on a set to mess with more bodies. Like, now that I know that's what the plan is, I'm not down with it. And so he actually apparently came in onto the set after filming one day and, like, requested that he was in on the set by himself. And he performed what people call an exorcism, but apparently another article called it a Muscogee blessing. I don't know which one it is, but even the cast and crew in an interview were calling it an exorcism, so I don't know if because they knew him that actually was what happened.
Like Muskegee?
Muskegee, is that how it's pronounced?
I think so, but I'm not... I don't want to make a claim, but I think maybe...
A M-U-S-K-O-G-E-E.
O-G-E. Because I know, like, Muskegee Airmen, but I don't know how that's spelled. Okay.
I don't want to be offensive. I'm just wildly ignorant, and I should have looked. but a blessing from, I'm imagining, like, whatever, what tribe he's from.
Very brave to be like, I want to be on set by myself.
He was like, nobody else is going to fuck with this. I know what I'm doing, and get out.
Muskogee, maybe. Sorry. Muskogee. It's with an O. I don't know. I feel like I keep thinking I know it, and then I say it out loud and go, I have no idea. So, sorry.
Muskogee sounds wrong to me. I don't know. You let us know. And I'm just sorry, by the way. I'm sorry. I'm just sorry.
Don't let us know, because it's just going to be Eva going, I didn't do this.
Well, I'll look it up, I promise. But anyway, he went in and performed some sort of blessing or some sort of ritual, and he didn't ever really explain to anyone else what he did. He just said he was going to cleanse the set. Mm-hmm. And people actually did come in the next day for work, and they did say that there was, like, a lightness. Wow. And everyone felt really relieved, and it felt different on set.
That's good.
And for the rest of filming, there was no incident.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
So thank you, Will Sampson.
It worked.
But this is also where I'm just going to throw in some additional deaths that did happen. I don't know if it's, like, I personally think it's kind of a stretch to consider them part of a curse, but... there did happen to be deaths pretty close to filming this, where Julian Beck, who played Preacher Kane, he died from stomach cancer just before the movie's premiere. Oh. So at the very least, it's this franchise is building a reputation of, like, not everybody makes it out alive.
Yeah.
After, like, if you're on the set, someone's not going to be alive by the end.
Jesus. Right, like, even statistically speaking.
Yeah. So after the film's release, Will Sampson, he died too from complications from a lung transplant.
No!
So then he's also dead. So that's two movies, three deaths, and also, like, some freaky, like mechanical clown and bolts of lightning shit.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, right, those kind of normal freak accidents.
Right. So then Poltergeist 3 comes out in 1987, and the only two people to reprise their roles are Zelda Rubinstein and Heather O'Rourke. And Heather O'Rourke played Carol Ann. She's the little girl that goes, "We're here." Got or it. "They're here." So she comes back for the third movie. She had just, ding, 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 Christine, she had just been diagnosed with Crohn's and was given regular cortisone shots before filming. And after principal photography wrapped, she was showing flu-like symptoms.
Oh, no.
And she collapses and is rushed to the hospital.
Oh, no.
And goes into cardiac arrest.
Oh, my. How old is she?
She's 12.
Oh, God.
The doctors find out that she was misdiagnosed and did not have Crohn's.
Oh, God.
She had a congenital bowel obstruction. Mm. And so when they went in for emergency surgery, she died of septic shock.
That's just so awful.
And not that this is any, this is, like, definitely not the worst part of it at all, but the movie happened to be a total flop because they decided that since she had just died right before the movie was going to premiere, they prohibited the stars from doing any promotion for the movie because they didn't want it to look like they were exploiting her death.
Yeah.
So since they didn't do any promotion, the movie never really, like, got paid attention to. And so the movie ended up flopping.
Oh, my God.
On top of it. So.
Horrible, horrible.
Yeah. So now that's a fourth death. And, I mean, she was 12 years old and literally just, like, dropped dead.
Baby.
And her parents did sue, saying that, like, had she been properly diagnosed, she might be still alive. And so there was all that mess as well.
Heavy, heavy, heavy.
So in 1992, this is after the trilogy has been made. In 1992, Richard Lawson, who was the guy who survived the cocaine overdose during the first movie, still some weird things happen because they think, okay, well, we're not making any more movies, but, like, you know, there are still people who are alive that worked on this. And, like, let's hope that, like, like, they all knew about the Poltergeist curse and they were like, well, let's see. Like, even though we're not making movies, maybe because we were associated with it at all, we might still not be in luck.
Right.
And so in 1992, Richard Lawson, he got on a flight to Cleveland, flight 405, and the plane crashed into a bay.
Oh, God.
27 people died, 24 people survived. He happened to be one of them, but he was stuck in, he got stuck in his lap belt.
Oh, my God.
Underwater.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And somehow survived.
Oh, he did.
But the reason he survived is because he ended up getting upgraded last minute, and the row that he was going to sit in, everyone died.
Jesus.
So he just survived because he got moved last minute, but he was still in some freak accident survived.
Yes.
He should have not survived.
That's terrifying.
In 2004, the director of Poltergeist 2, Brian Gibson, he dies of bone cancer, and in 2010, Zelda Rubinstein, who was also in the third movie, died of natural causes. So
isn't she the one who's the voice of that creepy show?
Oh, maybe.
I'm pretty sure that's her. At least a similar name.
Sounds right.
Yeah.
So those are two, again, like, they could be considered stretches, but it's just, I'm just adding,
to add to the,
putting all the deaths in one show for you.
Sure.
So in 2009, this is the weirdest one to me. In 2009, Lou Perryman, he played a small role in the original movie as the construction worker, his name was Pugsley. Mm. now he's 67 years old. He lives in Austin, Texas, hanging out at his house, and he gets a knock on the door. And a man named Seth Tatum opened the door, and witnesses saw them have a conversation on the front porch, and then Lou lets Seth into the house, and then later Seth is seen leaving the house alone. At some point, I guess people hadn't seen Lou in a while, and so they called the police.
Uh-oh.
And police show up to Lou's house and found him hacked apart with an axe.
What?
And talk about a freak accident, because Seth was recently released from prison and was apparently not taking his medication. He was reportedly wandering aimlessly for 3 miles and then at random chose Lou's house.
Yeah.
Not knowing who he was.
Oh, no.
And then knocked on his door, went in, killed him, and
holy
left.
Shit.
Yeah,
that's like the definition of just like
freak, just like randomness. Out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, imagine being like knowing about this poltergeist curse and being like, at any second, something fucking wild can happen.
Like lightning or a murderer or a plane crash. I mean, anything. Super. It's like Final Destination.
Truly. And again, a lot of people theorize that because all these people were somehow involved in messing with bodily remains, all of those spirits are like almost after them and trying to like get them back for disturbing their afterlife. So there was a reboot in 2013 of Poltergeist from 20th Century Fox and MGM. They announced that they were going to do a reboot. And in 2015, the director, Gil Keenan, he actually did a Reddit AMA about like, you know, ask me anything from us filming this reboot. And someone asked, like, has anything strange or unnecessary happened while you're filming? And so this was Gil Keenan's response. It's kind of long, but...
Ooh, okay.
Okay. So he says, the location for the house during shooting, I chose it because it had a strange and unnecessary field that the houses of this particular community were built around. And we found throughout production that we had persistent and repeatable equipment failure only on that strange plot of land.
Mm.
For instance, lights would turn on anywhere else in the neighborhood, but would blow out the second you try to light them on this plot. Also, I used a lot of aerial drone photography in the film, and the drone pilots were never able to lock in the GPS signal on this field. We would have to move 10 feet to launch the craft, and I was too afraid to find out what that land used to be. We filmed outside Toronto, somewhere between Buffalo, New York, and Toronto, Ontario, in a town called Hamilton. Also, the house that I rented during filming was straight up legit haunted by a female spirit dressed in black.
Okay.
And I became aware of her within the first few days of staying in the house, and only after I left did I receive a call from the previous owner who had moved back in, who was terrified by the goings-on in the house and wanted to see what I had done and if I had experienced any of it.
So he's like, oh, I only did a little thing called Poltergeist.
I only filmed something that's notorious for having a curse of people being surrounded in bad energy afterwards.
It's like quite an Airbnb review to leave behind.
Yeah. So it was an incredible real life inspiration for filming that followed me home. It didn't follow me back to LA, but it definitely followed me back from set to wherever I was sleeping during filming. And then last thing I have to say about this is they are rebooting it again, and in...
Why? Stop it!
It got announced last year that the Russo brothers, who are notoriously in my heart known for the Marvel Cinematic Universe, they are apparently going to be involved somehow in this franchise, and I swear to God, if the Russo brothers...
Careful.
If they die and the Marvel Cinematic Universe is not completed, I'm gonna lose it.
First Tom Hanks, now this.
Not the Russo brothers.
What are we gonna do?
So anyway, that being said, that is the Poltergeist curse.
Wowza.
Poltergeist curse.
I mean, even the fact that, like, a child died, that's just the odds of that. Like, especially all the actors.
I think the Heather O'Rourke, like, the little girl who died, I think the only reason everyone knows that one is because it's a little girl and so innocent and just happened out of nowhere, and she happened to be the main character of a haunted movie.
Right.
Where they were fucking around with skeletons that are real.
Right, right.
So, like, everything else kind of falls to the wayside. But, like, I didn't know about, like, the oldest daughter being strangled to death. I didn't know about Lou Pearlman and the axe. Like,
I mean, those alone in a plane crash, I mean, it's just a lot.
Yep.
Especially all the actors. It's not even just, like, random people associated.
Right.
Somewhat. It's, like, the main people involved. Wow, okay, that's quite a story.
Yes, I think so.
So, anyway, that is the...
That is that. And a lot of people have asked about it, so I hope that I did it justice.
I'm sure you did. So. That was creepy.
And That's Why We Drink is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. With Squarespace, it's easy to create a beautiful website all on your terms. You won't want to miss Fluid Engine. This is a next-generation website design system from Squarespace with reimagined drag-and-drop technology for desktop or mobile. And I'll be honest, this is a game-changer. Back when I made the And That's Why We Drink website, I used Squarespace. This was obviously well before they were a sponsor, and we have used them ever since. And it's unbelievable how easy this tool is. Any of us on the team can log in and move some things around, update things. We don't need like a dedicated webmaster to figure it out for us because it's so accessible. I love Squarespace. I've made many websites with it before, and it's really easy to get started. You can get one of their Squarespace professional website templates to use. They have designs for every category and use case. Then you can customize your look, update content, add features to fit your unique needs. It's just a really, really cool service. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/drink to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. You've probably heard about Burrow. It's a new kind of furniture company known for timeless design, durable materials, and details that make life in your space easier. Last year, they brought their expertise outside with the launch of their outdoor line, and now they're adding more must-have pieces to the collection. Dunes offers seating, dining, and lounger options, while Scout is a new folding chair upholstered in a chic woven fabric. Made of durable materials made for all seasons, weather-resistant teak, stainless alloy, quick-dry, stain-resistant cushions, love that, with easy assembly and disassembly. They also just launched a new standing desk co-pilot with adjustable height, a durable scratch-resistant body with built-in storage to make working at home easier than ever. And of course, there's Burrow's legacy seating collections like the Nomad and Range, now available in new colors. So no matter what you choose, you always get free shipping on every order, which can run up to $100 for larger items, and that is a win. You know Emma and I love our Burrow, and now that they have outdoor furniture, I'm very excited to get my lounge on. We have this balcony, and I am always looking for something to make it comfy but also look chic, you know, because it's outside, everyone can see it, and I want to look stylish while I'm bird watching. I love Burrow. It's easy to assemble. It ships free. I can't recommend them highly enough. And That's Why We Drink listeners can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/drink. That's Burrow, burrow.com/drink for 15% off. burrow.com/drink.
What have you got for me, Christine? A tall tale?
Just a really,
a short tale?
Really fucked up tale. How's that?
A puppy dog tale?
I wish I had that to offer you.
Okay.
After this, you can have some puppy dog tales.
Ooh.
This okay. is the story. Oops, sorry, everyone. This is the story of Jesse Pomeroy, the boy fiend of Boston.
Ooh, Boston. Okay.
Boston.
Boy fiend.
Props to Boston. I'm sorry that we won't be seeing you as soon as we had hoped.
Damn, I was so excited to be back in Boston.
Me too. We were so excited. Our hometown show at the Wilbur.
I called my friend and I was like, listen, I'm so sorry. Because we had so many plans. There was we had gotten a tiny house. We had gotten we were going to go to Salem. We had a lot of plans.
Yeah, I feel bad because my soon-to-be sister-in-law and my mother-in-law, both called off work, months ago. Aww. To make sure they were there that day. And I'm like, oh, sorry.
Yikes.
I feel bad. But, God, I hope we can, we will reschedule and we'll be back. But, for now, please just...
For now, enjoy this tale.
Take this horrible story. Okay, so, Jesse Pomeroy. So, this is kind of an old-timey story. It's from the mid-19th century.
I love it.
Very New England-y. So,
love it.
Jesse Pomeroy, he was born in November of 1859.
Oh, a Scorpio. I already hate it.
In Charleston, Massachusetts. Is that a Scorpio?
No, that's usually November,
isn't it?
Well, if it's early November.
Oh, sorry. I didn't say the date. November 29th. My bad.
Oh, that's Sagittarius.
My bad.
Damn. Okay, I really wanted to hate him.
I shouldn't have even corrected you. I'm sorry.
It's fine.
To two parents, Thomas J. Pomeroy, a Civil War veteran who worked at the dockyards, and a woman named Ruth Ann Pomeroy, whose maiden name was Snowman.
Shut the
I
fuck
I think it's
up.
Probably pronounced Snowman, but it's spelled like Snowman.
Oh my God, wait, so what was her full maiden name?
Ruth Ann Snowman. I didn't even see that. Ruth Ann Snowman. Snowman.
Aww, Ruth Ann the Snowman.
Ruth Ann the Snowman with a holly jolly soul.
So sweet.
Okay, so she was a dressmaker.
Like Santa Claus's dressmaker?
She was like Mrs. Claus. okay, so... Jesse had a typical upbringing. He had one older brother named Charlie, and he had a typical upbringing, except there was, according to most sources, physical abuse from his dad of both him and his older brother. So when he was little, he was very sickly. He was, quote unquote, strange looking to the people at the time, who were not very, obviously, you know, necessarily open-minded to things like that. He had a cleft palate. He had cataracts, which caused one of his eyes to be kind of white. And so he had these constant headaches and had like seizures pretty regularly throughout his childhood. So he was kind of regarded as like a freak or like different from the people around him.
Back in the day. Right. I was going to say, was this around the time where like freak shows were a thing? Is that part of the storyline?
It's not, but
okay. I didn't know.
I don't know if he's even that freaky enough to be in a freak show. As it sounds.
I didn't know if that was the storyline we're heading down.
A really good guess, but no. Unfortunately, it's not. It's just probably a lot worse.
I see. Okay.
Not that freak shows were not bad, but gotcha. Things just go downhill really quickly here. But he was like ridiculed for his cleft palate and his eye by the boys in his neighborhood. And the person who was most revolted by the way he looked was his father.
Oh.
Yeah. So one day Jesse skipped school, and his father blew up in anger, stripped him naked behind the outhouse, and whipped him. And that was like that became kind of just the regular occurrence. He was regularly beaten, and his older brother was occasionally as well, but Jesse got like the brunt of it. And people now think it was just because his father was so like disgusted by him.
Shit. Okay.
Yeah. And so around this time, like when he's probably like 7 or 8, he's caught torturing a neighbor's kitten.
Oh boy.
This is where things just go really south really quickly. I do want to also say, like, I mean, all my stories are disturbing, you know, equally in different directions, but this one is rather.
Trigger warning?
Maybe if you, you know, maybe if you,
Is it animal stuff?
It's not animal stuff.
Is it sexual assault stuff?
Not even really. It's just disturbing. I mean, I don't even know what to say, because it's like, I don't want to say, oh, this one's more disturbing than
a normal
case of someone getting murdered. I'm not saying that at all. It's pretty graphic.
Okay.
Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Because I don't want to give, obviously, varying levels to, like, whether one thing...
You don't want to compare one trauma to another. Yeah,
exactly. Especially because it's just, like...
But this one just happens to be a little more detailed in its graphic.
It's pretty detailed. I see. And that's kind of how the story has to be told for clarity's sake. So I just want to...
Right. Yes.
Maybe don't be eating lunch, or
we
maybe...
know you're not an asshole. You just kind of have to tell the story. Got it.
Yeah. Yikes. So things. This is one more pet thing. Ruth's pet canaries were then found dead, with their heads ripped off.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So this is just.
I see now where we're heading.
Yeah.
Got it.
This is just the start, and there's no more. I mean, to be clear, there's no more animal stuff, but there's people stuff, which.
Equally, if not worse.
Right, correct.
In the graphic department.
Yes. So her mother never, like, outright blamed him. I'm sorry, his mother never outright blamed him, but people think that she at least suspected it was him, because she never allowed a pet in her home or near her home ever again.
I see.
Although she said, of course, that wasn't him, but, you know, actions speak louder than words.
Sure.
So one day, Thomas, Jesse's dad, beats him so badly that Ruth, his mother, chases him out of the house with a knife, and he never returned. And at this point, according to contemporary sources, they divorced and he was out of the picture. So Jesse kind of eventually graduates, quote unquote, from torturing animals to other boys. He starts, what he would do is he would take... convince a friend or a neighborhood boy that he was going to go take him to see the soldiers or go to Barnum Circus, or he would kind of give them money to run an errand with him or a chore or whatever it may be, and would then lure them out to various locations, often outhouses along the marshlands or the railroad tracks, just very isolated spots.
Okay.
So here we go on a timeline of that.
Great.
December 22nd of 1871, William Billy Payne, a little boy, follows Jesse up to an area known as Powderhorn Hill, where Jesse forces him to strip off his clothes, then ties his hands to a beam, and then beats him up until he falls unconscious. Oof. And then leaves him there to freeze, basically. And
oh my God.
He does survive. He was found nearly frozen to death. He did recover, I mean, you know, to the extent that you could after something like that. He did recover, but he was unable to identify who his attacker was, except to say he was older. And that was all he could really, like, tell adults.
Okay.
So 2 months later, February 22nd, Tracy Hayden, who's 7 years old, is discovered in the same area. Tracy's assailant beat him, knocked out his front teeth, blackened both of his eyes, and threatened to cut off his penis, but did not. And so when they discover Tracy kind of also stuck, like, chained up and frozen out there
right.
and beaten up, Tracy says, yes, he was older, but he also had brown hair. So now they're adding
okay.
piece by piece to this description of who's wreaking all this havoc. A couple months later, May 20th of 1872, 8-year-old Robert Mayer walks up with an older boy up to Powder Hill, and he's seen walking with this older kid, Jesse, who strips him of his clothes again, and this time forces him to repeat curse words as he's, like, beating him.
Okay.
Which apparently sexually excites him. So he's kind
I
of
see.
Developing his MO, basically, and is, like, increasing the violence in specific ways that excite him. So Jesse eventually releases Robert, but threatens that he'll kill him if he tells anyone and leaves him out there. So around this time, people are like, holy hell, this
what
is
do
happening
we do?
Over yeah. and over to yeah. our children. This is terrifying. But sort of like...
At that point, I'd start having someone like on alert at that rock.
Yeah, right.
On that
specific
hill.
Yeah. yeah, exactly. So they were like, what do we do? But the problem was, like, these descriptions of Jesse became, like, tainted or, like, telephone almost. Like,
oh, okay.
turns out people started looking for a teenager with red hair, a wispy beard, and pointed eyebrows. Which
an elf.
Literally Mrs. Claus' assistant elf. Mrs. Snowman's assistant.
The one who wants to be a dentist, yeah.
Oh, yeah, so... So, basically, like, people were looking in the complete wrong direction for the assailant, and so let's just say he's not going to get caught.
Right, it's just making things worse because he's, like, uh-huh. going to get away with it.
Right, they're looking completely in the wrong direction. So then, 2 months later, July 22nd, 1872, an older boy, Jesse, is seen leading another child, 7-year-old Johnny, up to an outhouse on Powderhorn Hill. He is stripped, bound, whipped, and beaten as... Jesse masturbates. He tells Johnny that he will kill him if he leaves the outhouse and tells anyone what happened. Now, at this point, it's just every 2 months this is happening over and over and getting almost worse and more violent. So there's actually a $500 reward put out for the capture of the, quote, inhuman, diabolical scamp who's torturing little boys.
Oh, okay.
And it's right at this time that Ruth, his mother, rents out a dress shop and apartment in South Boston and moves her boys out of Chelsea where they were living. So it's theorized that she kind of suspected maybe her son was involved or behind the assaults. And
I can't imagine being a parent and thinking,
no,
like assuming that your kid's probably... involved
or having that like nagging feeling where you don't want to believe it but
right
yeah which is pretty much what they think happened. And there were a lot of vigilantes that emerged in the area looking for this $500 reward, and so she was like, they theorized that she was taking her boys away from the area to like keep them from away from harm of the vigilantes, basically, because she knew it might be her son.
Yikes.
However, she didn't say outright that she thought it
right.
was her son.
It's presumed.
So August 17th, again, 2 months later, 1872, George Pratt, a sickly 7-year-old little boy, follows Jesse away from the South Boston shore, this time and into the marshlands. This one is rough. George is stripped, bound, and beaten with a belt. Jesse bites a chunk of flesh from his cheek. Then he goes further, stabs him with a needle, and before he leaves, he also takes a bite out of his butt and
oh my God.
Leaves him there.
And he's alive still?
I believe he was left alive, yes. I'm not positive, but later on, people, the victims are not necessarily left alive, and I think
gotcha.
Those are very specific how the bodies were found, so I'm not sure.
Okay.
It was not clear in a lot of these older... sources, but I believe he survived.
Oh my God. Also, I mean, as his mom, though, it was probably a smart strategy of like, oh, if all of a sudden the stuff starts happening over here mm-hmm. where we moved, then I know for real if it's my kid.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Or it's just like, oh no, my worst fears have been confirmed. Right?
Really hoping it would stay in Chelsea.
Yeah. And I think just the fact that the kid was that it was clear that he'd been stabbed with a needle and all this stuff, I think that was his. I think he had survived and was telling like the order happened and all that. I'm like 95% sure on that. So September 5th, 1872, so only a month later this time, Jesse kidnaps a boy named Harry Austin and takes him up to the railroad tracks where he is stripped, bound, again, beaten with a leather belt. However, this time Jesse takes out a penknife and stabs him 4 times.
It's getting so much worse.
It's just getting more and more brutal. Jesse attempts to cut off Harry's genitals, but he hears people nearby and is scared off. And so once again, he just abandons this child. Only days later, it's like a week later. So now it's just getting like closer and closer together.
It's like every day someone else is going to get it 10% worse than the last one.
Right, right. So a week later, September 11th, 1872, this time Jesse lures 7-year-old Joseph Kennedy to the marshlands along the bay. Once again, he strips, binds, beats him, but he also forces him to his knees and tries to make him recite a profane version of the Lord's Prayer. Which, again, he's finding these ways to kind of, like, excite himself with curse words and, like, profanity and blasphemy and forcing people to do things.
Right, just being in power.
Exactly, yeah. So he tries to make him, but apparently Joseph refuses to blaspheme the Lord. He, like, refuses to commit blasphemy. Poor God, a 7-year-old. And so Jesse gets pretty mad, slashes him across the face with his penknife, then drags him to the salt water creek to force him to like wash the wounds in salt water. He did survive as well, so that's how we know that that's what happened.
Jesus. Oh my God.
But just like twisted torturous stuff developing. So a few days later, again less than a week now, September 17th, 1872, 5-year-old Robert Gould follows Jesse up to the railroad tracks where he is tied to a fence post and beaten. Jesse slashes Robert's head with a knife, then presses the blade to his throat. But railroad workers are approaching, like walking up the track, and so interrupt the attack and he runs away. And so finally, Robert Gould is the first victim to add like an actual helpful piece of identifying evidence to this case. And that's that his assailant had a milky eye.
Okay. And that's helpful.
It is. Yeah. And he compared it. Actually, apparently there was a marble, you know, people played fun games like marbles back then.
Right.
And, you know, pre-TikTok era.
As I'm getting older, by the way, I will take this moment to mention like, I'm kind of getting into like the billiards kind of thing. Like, the old people.
The, like classics?
Like, I'm kind of like, I'm trying to learn jacks and tiddlywinks right now.
I just learned jacks in Missouri because we were there. And
I'm like kind Blaise's of into sister. It. I kind of get it now.
It's fun.
Now I'm like, what age am I? Because I'm totally like.
It is a twist.
I'm like, where's the tiddlywink gang? The tiddlywinks. Like, I'm about to crush them.
Oh my God. Yeah.
But I'm sure marbles is also very fun.
I feel like marbles is fun. I don't really know. I feel like I maybe played it when I was little, but probably got bored. But yeah, jacks is fun where you'd like have to pick them up. It's hard.
I mean, I'm a pickup sticks. I'm very good at pickup sticks.
Love pickup sticks. That's been a while too.
So anyway, marbles, I'm ready to learn all about that.
Well, apparently there was a really popular marble called Milky, and it was like the way it looked. So he described this boy's eye as looking like that marble, and so that's how they kind of got the newest description of what the assailant looked like. So what they did next is they took Joseph Kennedy to all the schools in South Boston to see if he could identify his attacker. But Robert's, one of the other victims' mother, would not allow him to go because it was only 3 days after he had been attacked, and he wasn't well enough, and she was like, I don't want him involved in this. He needs to get better. So unfortunately, it was just Joseph being taken around, and he didn't recognize or perhaps didn't notice anybody who matched the description of what his attacker looked like. So Jesse Pomeroy once again escaped detection. But luckily, I don't know if that's the right word, later that day, for kind of an unknown reason, Jesse walked straight into the police station where Joseph was being questioned and like, you know, about his attack. Okay. Walked straight into the police station, and Joseph is like, that's him. That's the guy who attacked me. And so Jesse runs out of the police station, but officers catch him like a block away.
Okay.
And he's arrested.
Oh, wow.
So he's...
Why on earth was he there?
So I mention it later, but they think it's because he was getting off on like this like cat and mouse, like he wasn't caught.
Like, well, they always say like you can't like...
Scene of the crime type
you
thing.
You always have to come to the scene of the crime.
Yeah. Like, you want to be involved in it to an extent. And
also you want to know, like, what how well you're doing getting away with
that's
it.
That's true, yeah. Well, so he, apparently they think he walked in there because they'd gone through all these classrooms and he had not been recognized. And he was like, oh, they don't even know what I look like. And they think he just walked in to see if he could get away with it. Obviously, he did not. So he was arrested and he was questioned, but he denied everything. He shows no remorse. What a shock. And is put in a cell until midnight as the police try to get a hold of his mother, Ruth, his poor mother. At midnight, investigators take him out of his cell and they threaten a 100-year jail sentence if he doesn't confess to his crimes.
Whoa.
So he's like, yeah, I did it.
Okay.
And here are all the lurid details. I'm going to tell you everything.
Great.
So the following morning, they bring all of Jesse's victims in and they all individually identify him as their attacker. As they presumed, and he is taken before the magistrate. And Ruth, so his mother, like, almost to a pathological sense, defends him this entire time.
Oh, she's in such denial.
Total denial. And basically, despite all the actions of, like, I think she knows to some level that this is
her son. She doesn't want to admit it. Yeah.
She can't bring herself to admit it. And she said that all the other boys are liars and that Jesse is a good boy. He's honest. He's obedient. He's hardworking. He would never do something like this. So the whole time she's defending him. However, Jesse is sentenced to the House of Reformation in Westboro until the age of 18. And he is led away. His mother is distraught, still claiming he hadn't done anything. But he was basically being sent to this reform school until he's 18. So... weirdly enough, or maybe not that weird, he, like, thrives at this reform school because it's, like, a very barbaric environment. And, like, he could kind of take over and take advantage of other kids.
I thought you meant for a second he was actually, like, reformed.
Absolutely
or, like...
not.
Okay, I see.
Unfortunately.
He was thriving in his own way. Got it.
You know what? You're right. Thrive might not be the best word. He was a...
doing the best at what he does best.
Yeah, he was crumbling further into...
Devolving, some might say.
Ugh. Yeah. So most of the boys were there for nonviolent offenses like truancy, shoplifting, and apparently stubbornness could get you sent there. So
ass would be there.
You and I would be screwed, and we also wouldn't survive.
No, not at all. Especially if this guy was in our fucking cell.
Absolutely not. So Jesse, because he's so sadistic, basically becomes like the top of the social pyramid and has all of his ways of violence and sadism and that kind of thing. And he's able to kind of get all these other nonviolent boys under his own control. So this whole time, Jesse is like, quote unquote, thriving, developing his whole shtick, his whole evil, evil shtick.
Yikes.
And it's just getting worse and worse. And meanwhile, his mother is outside of jail and reform school. And she is petitioning anyone and everyone she can find to help pardon her son. Cause she's like, it is not him. Like, this is a huge mistake. So she's like doing all this
poor woman.
I know, it's awful. It's awful. Doing all this like activism, quote unquote, to try and get him pardoned. But pretty quickly, Jesse learns that if he wants to get out, he needs to show good behavior. And that's the only way he could be released early.
Great. So now he's fake thriving.
Yep, exactly.
I see.
As someone who is so good at manipulating and controlling and, like, clearly has no remorse whatsoever, he's extremely good at, like, being what people want him to be or seeming like he's what people want him to be. So he becomes, like, a dorm monitor, which is, like, an RA, basically, or like a prefect in Harry Potter, basically.
A prefect. God damn, I always wanted to be a prefect.
I was always scared of them. I was like, I would get in big trouble, I feel like.
My whole life, I always thought it was called a perfect, because I could not in my brain
move
them around, so I would always read them as perfects. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I get it.
I always thought it was perfect for a long time.
I know it's not, but I still, in my head, at 27, I have to, like, manually remind myself that it's not a
like
perfect
override your brain.
Yeah. But also it makes sense because you have to be like pretty perfect for people to trust you to be a perfect.
It must be a play on words. I think too, like, there's so many words in Harry Potter that she use that, like, I feel like since we read them growing up, there were so many words that, like, we read a certain way. Like, I remember,
like, reading Hermione at 9 years old.
That's the big one.
Again, in my head, I still think of her as, like, Hermoine.
Yeah.
And, like, then I saw the movie, and they're like, Hermione Granger. And I was like, what the fuck?
Who the hell is this chick? I was like,
where's Hermoine? Is Hermoine?
Where's my little ween? Yeah, Renee.
Where's my weenie Granger?
Renee used to call her Hermione. Hermione.
Yeah, I mean, how was a 9-year-old to know that?
I don't think any of us really knew it at the time. Nope. Thank God for Hollywood telling us how to pronounce things.
Thank God, years later.
Thank God for movies and TV to teach us to teach us all of our intellectual information. Okay, right. So he's basically a perfect. He's an RA, and he regularly reports his fellow students to the teachers. So he's basically a tattletale.
Such a Hermoine, am I right?
Such a Hermoine. Such a ween.
That's actually Weenie Hut Juniors.
Weenie. Yeah. So Jesse's exhibiting this, like, model behavior according to authorities. And meanwhile, Ruth on the outside is, like, saying he's so innocent and he did nothing wrong. And so that combined actually worked. And
oh, no.
Yeah. He was released 18 months into his 7-year sentence. So
I mean, job well done, but which, fuck you.
Also, think about it. If he was there till he was 18 and it was a 7-year sentence, that means he was 11 when this all happened. He was sent away at 11, and now he's getting out at, like, 12 or 13.
Wow. Isn't that horrifying? Did not even process that.
I knew he was, like, young, but I didn't know. That's really little. So, yeah, he's released 18 months in, so he's probably about 12 or 13 at this point. He now starts working at his brother. So his older brother, Charlie, has a newspaper shop and his mom still has a dress shop. So he starts working at both. And apparently even the local South Boston police were, like, amazed at his reformation, his thriving that he's doing.
His thriving, yeah, yeah.
All
yeah.
his thriving. And obviously the neighbors in the town were like, oh, hell no. Like, what the like, fuck?
We know what's going on.
Yeah, like, we're not letting our kids walk around if you're letting this guy free, but police were
I
like,
don't want a newspaper from you, thank you.
No, right, I don't want to buy my dress from Mrs. Claus. So basically he's returned to his previous environment pretty quickly. The townspeople are pissed, but the police are like, no, he's changed, you know. So guess what?
Let me guess. He's not a perfect anymore. He's not prefect anymore.
He's no longer a perfect prefect. I mean, it's exactly what everyone expects. Things get worse.
How quickly does he start ruining other people's lives again?
Oh, pretty much immediately. So okay. 6 weeks after his release.
There it is.
And it's really bad, y'all. March 18th of 1874, 6 weeks after his release, a little girl named Katie Curran vanished. And her mother, Mrs. Curran, immediately began searching for her daughter. And is horrified to learn first that Jesse has been freed from jail because she hadn't realized this yet.
Oh, shit.
And second, that her daughter had gone to, it's called Tobin's General Store, and she wanted to buy some notebooks, but the store was out of notebooks, so Mr. Tobin suggested she head to Mrs. Pomeroy's dress shop to buy some notebooks.
Well, there it is.
Where Jesse worked.
Also, if you're 12 years old, like, I'm imagining this girl was missing for a while, so, like, how are you a 12-year-old and, like, you have to come home, too, and have dinner. Where are you hiding another person?
I'll tell you. Oh, unfortunately, we find out in lurid detail, quote-unquote, what happened. So, yeah, it's twisted. So, Captain Dyer of the South Boston precinct, who is, you know, the precinct that's convinced he's changed, quote-unquote, assures Mrs. Curran that Jesse is reformed, but he said, you know what, we'll send an officer to check in order to calm the distraught mother and make sure that her daughter's not in harm's way. So, Ruth is at the dress shop, the police come, and they're like, we want to check and see if, you know, this little girl's here. And Ruth is pissed because she's like, no, this is not my son. Why do you keep harassing us? Yada, yada. But she's like, fine, take a look around. And they look around briefly. She kicks them out and they see nothing. So they're like, she's not here. But there is another 14-year-old named Rudolph Kaur who works at the shop. And he tells police, hey, I saw that little girl with Jesse earlier. But Captain Dyer says, this little boy, Rudolph, is a known liar.
And oh my God.
Because Jesse is reformed, there's no way that he's telling the truth.
Oh my God.
About seeing them together. So a witness apparently at this point tells police they saw Katie being lured into a wagon. And so the case goes from missing child to a kidnapping case, and it leads the investigation away from the shop. However, unfortunately, little did they know that Jesse had lured Katie to the cellar underneath where they were standing.
That makes so much sense.
Yep. And so okay. They didn't spot anything. They were told, hey, we saw her getting in a wagon over in town. So the police leave and leave Jesse to his ways in the cellar underneath. They wouldn't find her for several more months.
Oh, no. Months?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
She was dead for several months, though, right? She wasn't tortured for several months.
Oh, yes. She was dead for several months. Okay. Not, I mean, you know.
Yay.
All bad.
Yeah.
Our catchphrase, it's all bad. It's all bad. April 1870, but yeah, she wasn't, like, kept there for, sure. You know.
Between the two, I'd rather her not be tortured,
right. If it's going to go one way or the other, yeah. April of 1874, Jesse tries to lure 5-year-old Harry Fields to a secluded area, but a teenager spots them together, knows about Jesse's reputation, stops them, thank God, and Harry's able to escape. So only a few days later, April 22nd, Jesse escorts 4-year-old Horace Millen, a child who is described as beautiful and angelic, to a bakery. They purchase some cake and they share it, and he convinces him to walk toward the bay with him. So...
Where are these children's parents? Like, was this at a time where 4-year-olds just walk around the city to get by themselves? Or, like, what?
I don't know. Maybe it's after school. I'm not sure. I mean, think about it. If he's 12 or 13 and he's working at a shop, you know? Like,
what was the year again?
1874.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, this was probably before, like, Neighborhood Watch.
I still think about, like, whatever the era was where I think about, like, old-timey, like, Newsies New York, where, like, 8-year-olds are, like, smoking cigarettes, yeah. Like, sitting on the back
selling
of a car.
Selling newspapers, trying to get nickels.
Or, like, bumming rides off the trolley or something.
Right. I mean, even...
So, I guess 4-year-olds, it makes sense by, like, one of them would be wandering around.
And you wouldn't think, like, oh, people are dangerous. There's no stranger danger yet at this point, really.
So weird.
And, like, I mean, it wasn't until the 80s that people started getting that, like, stranger danger fear. So, it was a long time. It was, like, over 100 years till... people would even
I wonder what the stats were at that time compared to now of like I mean like 4-year-olds, it's not like they were developmentally smarter or like more capable of being on their own back then, right. But like why weren't there just 4-year-olds like getting hit by cars all the time and shit, like why
there
are we
weren't
here
that many cars probably.
Oh, that's good too. Oh, that's true, because I'm like I can't even imagine letting a 4-year-old just run around and hope it knows how to get home.
Yeah, I mean I guess if you think like
I don't know. I don't know anything about it to even make a call, but from my pure ignorance, I can't understand
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, if you think it's, like, out in a suburb of Boston and, you know, kids are employed and I'm sure parents are... I don't know.
If anyone happens to be from 1874, let me know, please.
Let me know.
Yeah, I'd love to understand how 4-year-olds were just fucking hanging around. Even, like, 10-year-olds, like, with jobs and, like...
Yeah. Anyway, I guess they depended on it, but also think about, like, the lifespan was so much shorter back then, too. So, I don't know. I think people just matured, quote-unquote, much faster, like, they were expected to do.
Maybe.
People were getting married in, like, their teenage years. You know, people are just... It's just a different...
It's just bananas.
It was a different time.
I wish I knew more about that time.
You know, it is interesting, because it's such a different social... But, I mean, even nowadays, like, you know, kids get kidnapped and...
Yeah.
People terrorize towns and...
I never understood how, like, Hey Arnold could walk around New York.
Oh,
and
yeah,
he was a 9-year-old.
That one was always fascinating.
And you just trusted he, like, wouldn't get hurt.
I feel like I was wandering around town by then. By age, like, 11 or so, I started being able to walk up to, like, the grocery store and, like...
Nope.
Yeah. I don't know.
Not a million years for my Jewish mother.
Yeah.
Not a million fucking years. I'm still not allowed to walk by myself when I go home. I wasn't allowed to be on the highway until I was like 20.
Oh my God.
My mom is convinced I'm going to die from the coronavirus, by the way. She called me today and she was like, if you need to come home for a month, absolutely you can come home. And I was like, why? How would that be more helpful?
Get on a plane.
Yeah, exactly.
Why don't you? And come to D.C.
She's absolutely convinced that at any second I will just drop
and then
dead.
M was like, yeah, you can help and send me some toilet paper. And she's like, okay, here's 4 rolls.
Yeah. My mom likes to do this thing where she's wildly, like, stereotypically a helicopter parent when it's not asked of her. And then when all of a sudden I legitimately ask for help, which you would think that's the moment that my overprotective mom would go into hyperdrive. That's when she, like, doesn't give
a
shit.
It's no fun anymore.
It clearly isn't. One time, I literally had salmonella at one point.
Yeah,
and I called my mom, and I was like, hey, mom, the one who has always warned me that one day I would have salmonella and then die from it. I literally have salmonella. And she went, you're fine. And then hung up the phone because she was at a horse race. She was like,
excuse me, I'm at a horse race. How dare
you? You're getting in the way of my free time. And then one time, like, she would not let me get on a highway until I was 20. But then she brought me to Boston, and 20 minutes into living there, she was like, I have a meeting in Connecticut. I'll see you there tomorrow. And I was like, how the fuck do I get to Connecticut? And she was like, I don't know, figure it out. And then left.
I love that was grad school too. You were like, what do I do?
I was so sheltered. I was so, and like, then when I need to learn, my mom's like, I don't know how to teach you. Just figure it out. But yeah. Then I'm like, oh, I probably won't get the coronavirus. And she's like, no, you'll die.
Here's four rolls of toilet paper.
She tries her best to, like, she's always nervous. The best way I can describe it is she's always nervous I'm going to die. But when the time comes that I am probably going to die, she does not know how to be a nurse. She just wants to warn me so that she never has to get to the point
there's no
to
guilt. Take care there's of no me. There's no guilt there. She can just be like, I told you.
She'd be like, you shouldn't have eaten that raw chicken then. What did I tell you?
Yeah.
Moving on. Sorry. I'm thinking of my mom raising me in 1874. Yeah. And at 30,000 years old, she'd still be like, you are not stepping out of this building.
Okay. It's making a lot more sense. Yeah. Because I feel like for me, it's not that weird that kids would walk around. I mean, especially in the 1870s. But like, I don't know. We ran around a lot as kids. I mean, I'm not going to be that way because I'm too paranoid now after doing this podcast. But I don't trust my genetics to pass on to a child to be like a survivor in any scenario. So, but I mean, we got to run around with our friends and like, you know.
No. My mom's still like, where are you going? Who are you going with? When are you going to be back? What are you doing? I'm confused. Are you hungry? Like every single question that could be solved with like, leave me alone. You'll find out in an hour.
Listen to my podcast. I'll tell you there.
Yeah.
Well, so anyway, unfortunately, a four-year-old named Horace was somehow talked into eating a piece of cake and walking to the bay with Jesse.
If someone offered me a piece of cake, I'd probably do anything they wanted to. Remember, to be fair,
clothesline cookies? You were like, I would have come running too.
Episode two.
So several people actually later had said they had seen Jesse with Horace walking along the marsh. Apparently, they stopped in a secluded area of the marsh, and this is where things get graphic. I just want to let you know now. Jesse pulled out his penknife and he slashed Horace across the throat.
Shit.
But Horace survived the initial attack, and Jesse got so angry that it didn't kill him that he stabbed him over and over 18 times in the chest.
Oh my God.
And pretty immediately killed him that way. Once Horace had passed, Jesse stabbed him in the eye. Yeah.
Oh my God.
And begins to cut at his genitals. And this, at this point, it's not even a torture thing because he's had dead. Already died. Yeah. Right. But this just goes to show how like graphic and mutilating he was.
And how much anger he had.
How much anger, exactly.
So violent.
To a child, yeah. And he was a child. I mean, it's just so twisted. So Horace's father, around lunchtime, realized his son's not home. And so, I mean, I think it wasn't even just like the kids were necessarily wandering around, because, I mean, their parents knew, like, hey, there's this person on the loose.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, if... I'm sure you can talk a four-year-old into like, no, it's fine. Like, I'm another kid. Just walk to the store with me. Like, I don't know how but his father noticed pretty immediately that his son was missing from their house or their shop or wherever they were. And so, unfortunately, right around the time he was reported missing, he had actually just been killed. So around 4 p.m. that day, two boys stumbled upon Horace's body and called police. And obviously... there's one suspect that everyone's like, hey, we know who the fuck it is, guys. It's pretty obvious. Remember that kid you literally left out or got out of jail? So the Boston chief of police and the news reporters were like, no, isn't he locked away in reform school? And then South Boston precinct was like, oh, no, yeah, like we took him out of there. He's roaming free again. And everyone's like, well, fuck.
People are like, God damn it.
What are you doing? Yeah. So, despite his mother's protest, she's still saying he's innocent. Jesse was immediately picked up by police and taken in to be questioned. At first, he denied everything. He said he didn't even see Horace that day. However, there is blood on his shirt, marsh mud on his shoes, blood on his penknife, and scratches all over his hands and face. And they were like, likely
me
story.
Methinks something's happened.
He's like, I was just working in the dress shop all day.
It's been fucking wild over there. You have no idea.
I have not quite figured out how to use a sewing machine, and it ended badly. To be fair, that is kind of how I use a sewing machine, so.
Sure.
I wouldn't blame him. So they confiscate the knife, compare it to Horace's wounds. Immediate match. They know this is the knife that stabbed him. They take his shoes. They had these, like, a new form of investigation, which were these plaster imprints of shoe prints at the, in the mud, and they matched perfectly to his shoes. And at this point, Jesse was like, you can't prove anything. And so they took him to the mortuary to be like, hey, you want to see his body? Here, this is what you did. And apparently at this point, he confesses. He's like, yeah, I did that.
Wow.
And I don't know if it was like a guilt thing.
Or pride.
I don't think it was a guilt thing because it seemed to be that in every other scenario, there was never any remorse. But maybe they scared him into it, you know, with a threat of like 100 years in jail.
Right.
This time, Jesse's mother, Ruth, insists that her son has attorneys. Again, Jesse starts denying the charges. He recants his entire confession. And he says he was somewhere completely different on the day of the murder. But despite all his new, like, tales, he's indicted on first-degree murder pretty quickly.
Wow.
And a month after his arrest, Ruth, his mother, and Charlie, his brother, are forced to close their businesses and move out of town, which doesn't surprise me that the town was like, get the fuck out of here. Mm. So the neighboring shop owner was like, I'm going to expand into their old space. And in the process of cleaning out the cellar, they discovered the body of Katie Curran, who had gone missing April. So, or in March. So Mrs. Curran was brought to the scene to identify the body, but they only showed her the clothing because the body had decomposed so badly. And Mrs. Curran was beside herself with grief, but confirmed that yes, it was indeed her missing daughter, Katie. And then Ruth and Charlie are arrested as accessories to murder because this had happened underneath their shop.
Oh, shit.
So Jesse confesses to the killing of Katie, and he says he hid the body in a pile of ash and stone, but he says his mother and brother were not involved. So
that's nice of him.
Yeah. How sweet.
Yeah.
So before the trial, Jesse is examined by two alienists. Do you know what an alienist is?
No. An alien princess?
Yep. No, it's like a word for psychologist in the 19th century. It was like the first incarnation of a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
I've never heard that.
Basically, so I looked up why it was called that. Apparently, this is what it says on Psychology Today. It was the alienist's job to study, understand, care for, and assist patients in overcoming their mental alienation or mental illness.
Oh, okay.
Which is why they were called alienists.
Alienists with a T. I thought you said alieness, and I was like, an alien princess? I don't know.
Yeah, that one you're right on, yes.
I see.
That one is correct. That one is correct. Alienists. Sorry.
Okay, right. Okay, that checks out.
Yes. So his defense was not that he didn't commit the crimes, but that he didn't have the capacity to understand that he was wrong, like morally wrong in committing the crime. Then the defense, so the defense was going basically for an insanity plea. And the alienists on his side were arguing that he was insane, but then under cross-examination, they did admit that, yes, they think Jesse knows what he was doing is wrong. Like, he's not incapable of understanding you are not supposed to do this.
Right.
Whether you feel guilty or not, like...
He should at the very least know to stop himself
from it. He knows he's not allowed to do this. So one thing that all three of the alienists who were on the case agreed upon is the fact that Jesse Pomeroy was an irredeemable, incurable threat to society and should be kept away from people at all costs.
That's what I call Christine.
Oh my God, yeah, that's why I call you an alienist. the debate became at this point, like, whether Jesse, so they were like, well, he's guilty, but like, what do we do? Should we execute him or should we put him away for life? And so it didn't take long, like, to render a guilty verdict, but he was so young that people were like, we don't know if we want to,
execute a child.
Exactly. But it was a punishment under Massachusetts law for first degree murder. And so the judge apparently said the law is the law. And in February of 1875, he passes down the sentence of death on Jesse Pomeroy.
Wow.
This whole time, Ruth is like, nope, he's innocent. And she actually blames Katie and Horace's parents for Jesse being in jail. And they're
because your kids look so killable? Like, what?
Right,
the
exactly,
hell?
Exactly. It made no sense. But she still, to that day, was still arguing on his behalf.
Yikes.
So it took 2 years. He was languishing on death row, and two governors came and went. And Jesse's sentence was eventually commuted to life in solitary confinement. And he was taken off of death row. So he actually spent 41 years in solitary confinement. He learned languages. He wrote books and poetry. Yuck, I don't want to read that. He denied any and all responsibility for his crimes whole time. Said he had nothing to do with it.
Great.
But then as soon as he's put back in the general population, rather than solitary confinement, he begins bragging about his crimes. And he, like, loves the attention from all the other inmates. And he loves to be, like, the scary,
right,
awful one. And so... So this is kind of where it comes back to, like, him walking into the police station, because he acted this way, like, he bragged about his crimes, and he loved to talk about them. That's why they think maybe he was excited about the fact that, like, he hadn't been recognized and wanted to walk into the police station that one day to, like, see how far he could push it and, like, see the actual result of his crime, like a cat and mouse game almost with the police.
Yeah.
So, basically... the biggest punishment to him of all was that the public just kind of lost interest in him and his case. You know how, like, these murderers are just, like, get off on, like, the attention? And
yeah, and no one cared.
No one cared anymore. And so, according to guards and wardens at the, what do they call it, criminally insane institution.
Sure.
So, apparently, according to the wardens, as soon as the people in the general population, like, of the prison didn't, or of the center didn't know much about him, or he wasn't, like, nobody knew offhand who he was or anything like that, he became really withdrawn, depressed, like, just stopped participating with other people, and, like, his whole thing that he gained energy and, like, self-importance from was just gone. Because, like, nobody
like, no one cared. Was validating anything that he wanted.
So, he tried to escape jail many times and failed every single time.
Kelsey Priest.
According to the Boston Globe, he made 10 to 12 escape attempts, often creating tools in his cell by himself. A prison warden reported finding rope, steel pens, and a drill that he had...
A drill? How do you smuggle that in?
I don't know. Damn. I guess he had, like, 50 years to do it. According to the Globe, Pomeroy lost an eye after attempting to destroy the side of his cell by redirecting a gas pipe to
try
and blow a hole in the wall. So he, like, literally lost an eye over it. Didn't escape, obviously. According to a 1914 psychiatric report, Pomeroy had shown the greatest ingenuity and a persistence which is unprecedented in the history of the prison. So, good job.
Huh.
So, Jesse died on September 29th, 1932, still incarcerated. And he is considered an organized slash lust serial killer, which is sort of like Ted Bundy and Dahmer. Like, he did it out of just a want, a desire to,
sure,
a need to. So no one with any familiarity with the case has any doubt that, like, if he hadn't been caught when he finally was, his body count would have just continued.
Sure.
Like, yeah, there was no stopping him. Yeah. He was described as manipulative, methodical, demonstrating no remorse or acceptance of responsibility for even the most minor of infractions. Prison psychologists noted how he manipulated his mother over and over over the years, and she continued to proclaim his innocence, and he could always convince her that he had nothing to do with it. But that ended in 1915 when Ruth passed away, still professing her son's innocence to the day she died. And after that, no one else bothered to visit Jesse ever again.
Wow.
Whew, that's the story of Jesse Pomeroy. It's a big one. I'm sorry.
Wow.
It's one I've wanted to do for a long time, but it's just a lot.
Well, yikes.
Boston, sorry, we won't be seeing you this
glad
month.
We're not going, actually, a little bit now.
Yeah, what the fuck, Boston? What's the matter with you?
Yikes. No. Yowza, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
It's a doozy.
You're welcome. Is everyone thanking me?
Everyone is pleased.
I'm sure. Everyone feels really good about themselves.
Well, great. I don't know where to go from here. Do you have anything?
I'm just going to say, I'm not going to say come see us live because that's not seeming to work right now. So just check us out, and that's PrayDrink.com. Also, I mean, if you want, you can follow our social media. That's where we're posting, like, updated dates and that kind of thing. So if you are concerned, check there first because that's where we'll post anything.
ATWWD Podcast is our handle.
Yes,
for
sir.
All things.
For all things. Check it out, and soon we're going to have our Space Camp video up on Patreon.
Yes, and there's a little kitty cat doing some stretching over there.
That's right so underneath sweet. Skylar.
Oh, so sweet.
On that note,
and
that's
why we drink.
Oh.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.